I'm Dan Hartnett, and I'm a professor at Kenyon College. Whenever I'm socializing with my colleagues, I inevitably end up asking them questions about the fascinating research they do. I thought other people might be interested in our conversations too. So I decided to start a podcast to ask Kenyon faculty about their research, their fields, and how they get students involved. This is the Kenyon College Profcast. My guest today is Dr. Cheryl Hemkin. Cheryl has been at Kenyon since 2003, where she has taught in the chemistry department and contributed to neuroscience and scientific computing. Her scholarship centers on chemicals in the brain that affect little understood cells called astrocytes. Exploring the role these cells play in the brain may in time contribute to advances in our understanding of diseases such as epilepsy, Alzheimer's, or Parkinson's disease. In addition, Cheryl has organized a community project for her chemistry students in which they go to a local elementary school periodically to provide rudimentary drug and science education. Cheryl is currently serving as associate provost at Kenyon and was recently promoted to full professor. I sat down with Cheryl in November of 2019. Cheryl, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and congratulations on becoming full professor.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. It's, as always, a team result, so I appreciate all of that, all the support I've gotten from Kenyon and the community.
Let's get some basics out of the way first. You describe yourself as a computational physical chemist. Can you break down those terms for me? I'm pretty sure we know what a chemist is for the most part, but the other two are a little bit new.
Yeah, so I'll just start with the computational first. That really comes because my research has been computational over the years. I use computers to study chemicals and how they work in the world, as opposed to pouring chemicals like you traditionally think out of a chemist. And then the physical part comes because that's the subdiscipline of chemistry that I have been trained in. In a loose sense, it gets towards the ideas of how chemicals, their movement and their energy influences how they interact with the world. An analogy would be if you'd go to a party, you go in with a really sad face and you just sit on a couch, your interaction with the environment of the party is going to be much different than if you'd go in and had a higher energy smile on your face and you were dancing. Similarly, molecules that move faster and have higher energy interact with the world around them differently than those that are lower energy. So that's kind of where the physical chemistry, computational and physical chemistry comes.
This is really interesting. Do you sometimes think about how these molecules are, in fact, sort of interacting with each other on almost a human-to-human level? I mean, I've never heard of this before.
Actually, that's the way we talk about it a lot. I anthropomorphize a lot. And yeah, think about those interactions are like how we interact with one another in certain respects. And sometimes it gives you a little bit of insight if you can't see at that very tiny molecular level.
What can you tell me about different types of cells in the brain?
So probably the most popular or the most well-known cell is the neuron. That's the one that typically is responsible for our ability to breathe or our ability to move and think. And so that's the one that's tended to have a lot of experiment done with it. Astrocytes, on the other hand, the cell you mentioned that I'm working with, those guys are also very common in the brain and the spinal cord. However, they're not seen as doing quite as much, or at least that's been the thought for about the 120 years that they've been known. So I think they're kind of important, or at least they're very interesting, because they locate themselves at some kind of critical places in the brain. They wrap themselves around where the neighboring neurons meet. And so if you think about your ability to breathe or your ability to move, it has to do with neurons being able to communicate, send signals to and from one another. Astrocytes are at those junctions where the signals transfer. And so it seems like they have at least the opportunity to have some influence on, you know, what happens in the brain. Probably not just the movement, those really fast movements that we have to make, but perhaps helping the brain stay healthier or keeping the environment more healthy.
And what are some big questions that scientists are currently asking about astrocytes?
Well, as you mentioned, there's not been a lot known about astrocytes. It hasn't been until perhaps the last 40 years, perhaps, that experiments have kind of kicked up in terms of people looking at astrocytes, wanting to know more seriously what they do. And in that process, there have been some research groups that have found some relationship between astrocytes and things like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, as well as disorders like epilepsy. But in order to figure out whether that's an important connection or not, we really need to know more about the chemistry that goes on within those cells.
Are all astrocytes inside of the nervous system?
All the astrocytes are in the brain and the spinal cord. So, yeah, it's a specialized type of cell that's found there.
And has our focus on neurons caused us to maybe not ask as many questions as we could or should about some of these other cells that accompany them?
I'd like to say yes, but I think the clear importance of neurons means that it's going to be a primary target for science. And then once you start understanding how those neurons work, then you move to those cells that may be support cells or those that you think of as secondary, because those are your next targets. So I think that's really where we are, is that we're at the point of trying to really understand more holistically how the brain functions and not just the neurons, which seem so cool and important.
Now, how do you use math to learn about these chemical processes?
So what we do is we try to characterize the movement of a molecule from one place to another, or an ion. In this case, it would be calcium ions from one place to another. And if you ever took a calculus class, which not everyone does, there are ways to use math to understand how flows and how changes in location occur. And so that's kind of what we're doing. So we're using something called ordinary differential equations to try to characterize the movement of these molecules.
So if I walk into your lab, am I mostly going to see computers?
Yeah, it doesn't look very special at all. It looks like a regular room. A lot of physical chemistry laboratories, or those that will use computers or theory, those guys tend to have just a regular room, lots of couches or coffee makers and computers.
Now, when we're talking about astrocytes, are you interested primarily in the human brain, or are you interested in mammal brains or brains more in a larger sense? Talk me through sort of what your primary area of interest is.
So those big questions you were talking about, those are what really motivate us to do our work, trying to ultimately hope that we can find a way to intervene in some of these diseases and disorders, which are so difficult for people to manage. That said, we're nowhere close to that point of understanding how astrocytes intersect with those large scale questions. We've got to start at the bottom. We've got to start at the base and build a foundation to get there. So what we're really trying to do is understand how a few chemicals that seem to be important in determining how the cell behaves, trying to understand how those few chemicals move around in the cell and how on-off switches can be turned. Like, how do you turn metabolism on or off in the cell? Or how do you ramp it up and ramp it down? How do you direct what types of chemicals leave the cell and potentially could interact with the neurons? So we're really looking to try to understand the individual cell, the individual astrocyte, to some extent, and hoping that will give insight to other people to be able to build up and add a little bit more to the knowledge. And slowly, hopefully, that building will bring us out to a place where we can say, oh, maybe that's a good intervention point for an epileptic seizure or for Alzheimer's.
Okay. So it seems like it might be difficult to observe directly the interactions that are going on within astrocytes. They're so small, they're in living brains. Is that one reason for the computational approach?
So yes, in effect, that's the reason for the computational approach. It's right now impossible to put all the instruments in and try to understand all the movements of mm-hmm. all the chemicals simultaneously in one particular cell. So what we do is we take information from experimenters that work on one particular part of the astrocyte, and we try to mathematically marry that to information coming from experimenters working on a different part of the cell. So we're trying to basically build a virtual cell out of the individual parts that people have worked on.
And are you working primarily with data that comes from animal subjects or?
So the information that we use will come from any place. Sometimes people are working with mice, sometimes they're working with rats, sometimes they're working with chickens. None of them are alive. It's cells derived from a chicken brain or a rat brain. But that kind of indicates the state of where our knowledge is. It is at such a rudimentary, such a basic state that we are combining information from a lot of different sources, experimental sources. So does it make a perfect model of a human or a rodent or anything? The answer is no. But right now it's better than what we have, which is very little.
Why is it important for everyone to know something about chemistry?
To me, it's important to know something about chemistry in part because a lot of chemicals seem to get demonized. We start to think about all chemicals as being bad. Advertisements tend to talk about ice cream that has no chemicals added.
Is that a possibility?
And that's the problem, is that chemicals are everywhere. Water is H2O. It's a chemical. You can't get away from them. They are there all the time. But to me, that's also kind of the magic, is that it is the foundation of who we are. It's the foundation of our food. It's the foundation of our drink. It's what makes up the body. What I hope people start to realize is that to be healthy, sometimes you have to understand there are better types of chemicals to put in our body. For example, water versus a lot of sugary drinks. There are times when salt is appropriate. That salt delivers a lot of sodium to the body. For some people, that doesn't work well. It raises their blood pressure. But for other people, it doesn't have a huge effect. So what I'm hoping is that people start to understand how chemicals interact in the body so they can make good choices, healthier choices, when they choose to eat or drink.
This might be a good time to turn the conversation a little bit to your community project that you did with your students. You took your students to teach sixth graders at St. Vincent's about drugs and the body. Can you describe the outreach project to me?
So this project started from a partnership with the Knox County Health Department. They survey local youth about drug use, and that survey indicated that the youth want to know more than don't do drugs. They want to know why drugs are bad for them. So they want more information, and they want more information about how drugs are bad for them with respect to their body. So that gave me an opportunity to think about projects that some of my upper level chemistry students could do. And from that came the development and implementation of these science-based drug education modules that we brought over to St. Vincent's. So our contact at the health department, Ashley Deidinger Phillips, she got us in contact with Sharon Tharp over at St. Vincent's and got us into the classroom.
So when you say drug, are you talking primarily about illicit substances, or are you talking sort of more broadly about chemicals, how people interact with chemicals and chemicals interact with the brain?
So the health department is particularly interested in drugs. Like for sixth graders particularly, they're going to have opportunities to get involved with nicotine or alcohol. So the health department is primarily interested in getting educational modules out about those substances. Mm-hmm. However, to try to prime that understanding for sixth graders or for anyone, we're looking at the idea of a drug as anything that we take into our body so that we can see some parallels between compounds or substances we typically take into our body and use that as a stepping stone to understand more clearly what could be happening with something like alcohol consumption. So we typically have started our modules out by looking at sugar and thinking about taking some table sugar, which is the chemical sucrose, putting that on our tongue, and that automatically gives us a sensation of sweet. And so we think about why that could come about. And so we've taken and used some analogies in the sixth grade class of using a baseball and a baseball glove, the baseball being the sucrose molecule or the sugar molecule, and the glove being akin to the taste bud or the receptor, a particular part of the taste bud on your tongue. And thinking about the interaction of the sugar with that special place on your taste bud being like the interaction of a baseball and the glove. Hmm. And when those two interact, the baseball and the glove, or the sugar and the taste bud area, that sends a signal off. That interaction sends a signal off to your brain that's interpreted as sweet. And this type of interaction, like the baseball and the glove, that type of interaction happens with all different types of chemicals that we take into our body. And so we think about it not just with sucrose, but when then we start thinking about caffeine, mm-hmm. and use that again as a way to step into thinking about how something like ethanol, the main chemical in consumable alcohol that affects our brain. Ethanol, when it interacts with certain receptors in our brain, it causes some confusion or causes us to have difficulties with coordination. And when ethanol interacts with other parts of our brain in a similar way, it can start the cycle of addiction. Hmm. And similarly, we can talk about nicotine.
So it sounds like in part, you're not just teaching this chemical is bad, you're teaching chemical thinking, understanding it as interactions and processes rather than stuff.
Exactly. And then we're also hoping that this will help people think not just of alcohol as being bad, but you'll be able to perhaps make the leap to, okay, why might you want to not take heroin? It operates on the same level, the same idea, only it has even more substantial negative outcomes. Or you might want to think about how is, I don't know, my antibiotic working? Hmm. It's got similar ideas and how the antibiotic works in the bacteria cell. So I'm hoping it's not just a end of the road lesson, but it's a way to think more broadly about how things you put in your body actually have effects.
So how did this experience affect your Kenyan students? What was their response to it?
I think there were two ways that there was an effect. Some of it is in terms of just learning more about how chemicals work in your body. Mm-hmm. We often talk in chemistry about very close interactions between one chemical and the other. And we stop there and we don't think about the behavioral implications that may come from that or the health implications. So it kind of drew the chemistry out into the larger world. Like, what are the larger world implications? So I think that was a little bit different than we sometimes think. And then the other major part was thinking about communicating. As much as communication isn't normally part of the chemistry curriculum, it is a huge part of what we'll have to do after we leave the department. Whether you become a teacher or a doctor or a scientist, you have to be able to communicate with the larger public. And so I'm hoping that this helped us start to think a little bit more about how to form analogies or how to make translations of pretty complicated topics to change the wording a little bit such that it is more accessible to the larger public, so we can have better dissemination of information, better uptake by the public, so people really understand, if you're at a doctor's office, what that doctor is trying to tell you about your health and how to improve that.
Now, the students who worked with you on this outreach project, have they been involved in your lab work on astrocytes?
So none of them overlap at all. So these are all different students. A lot of my students in the classroom were chemistry students, but in this past year, I think there was a total of 7 majors represented. Quite a few of them in the science division, from neuroscience to biology. But we also had a studio art major that had taken some chemistry classes, an anthropology major that also had taken some chemistry classes early on. So
it almost sounds as if this is good preparation for them, no matter what their background is, to get into a field like public health, which we don't have a specific focus on at Kenya.
So it is a great way. It is a good mix into public health, certainly. But again, I'm hoping just the general communication aspect will serve them well, regardless of what discipline they go to, because we all have to communicate our understanding of the world or our theories and ideas to the larger world. I guess in much the same way I'm trying to do right now.
Well, that's one of the formats of this podcast, right, is the idea that you get to speak to people who aren't just experts in your own field. Now, I'm going to ask you a bit of a strange question. I noticed the other day when we met up to get coffee that you ordered decaffeinated tea, which actually I also ordered, it turned out. But as a chemist, are you acutely aware and particularly careful or cautious about what chemicals you ingest and what you come in contact with? I mean, I'm trying to get at the question of how do you perceive the world when it comes time to interact with it and consume things?
I have become more careful with time. I'm not certainly one that always makes the healthy choice, and my choice of tea was more colored by I don't really like the taste of coffee. But yeah, I do. It has made me more aware of what I do put in my body and try to make the healthier choices, because now I've become a little bit more aware of what those negative outcomes could be if I eat too much sugar or if I drink too much alcohol. The enjoyment or whatever I think I will get out of it just doesn't seem to be worth the potential negative side.
Now, I often see things like BPA-free on packaging and things like that. Is that something you're particularly concerned about? Or is it, as a chemist, you know, there are such low levels? I'm really curious because I see one thing and all I know is what I've seen in popular media, which is not necessarily reliable. But you know the real scoop on some of this. How do you view notices like that?
Curiously, the BPA-free stuff, we have done little projects about that in my introductory chemistry class, because it is a really interesting chemical and interesting study in general. For me, because I'm an adult, I wasn't as worried about BPA as I would have been if I had children, because BPA is, it can act like a hormone in a similar way that we talked about the sugar molecule fitting into the receptor and causing effects. The BPA molecule is postulated to be able to interact with areas of the brain that normally would involve estrogen. And so it can potentially cause development of younger children before their time. And so for that reason, people were concerned, I think rightly concerned. I think part of the interesting part of that story is that the science was perhaps communicated well enough that the manufacturers started removing BPA from their products before there was a huge outcry either within the government or the public. And I think that was one place where perhaps there was a success in communication as well as I think the manufacturers probably didn't really need that chemical in their packaging.
So Cheryl, what are you working on right now? What are your plans moving forward?
So right now it's kind of an odd time because I am working in the provost's office, but I am keeping my research group going. So I've got older lab students that are still working with me and a couple newer folks that are coming on board. We'll continue to work on the astrocyte project, perhaps in a little bit different way than we have before. But like I said, there's so much yet to be explored with astrocytes. I think there's, you know, certainly more than a lifetime of opportunities for me and my group, let alone all the other people that are working on this. I'm also working to get another group of students together so we can go back over to the middle school and continue our project there. We've worked a little bit more to increase the different chemicals we look at with those kids. And so we'll probably try to add in a little bit about marijuana and THC and CBD. So I'll be able to keep my hand in all of this and change it up and hopefully increase our understanding of some of these topics to a little extent.
Is there something you wish non-chemists knew about your field?
I think the main thing I wish non-chemists knew about my field was that it's kind of interesting and it's not as scary as what you typically perceive. So my cousin, when I originally talked about doing the sixth grade project, she said, the one thing she said was, whatever you do, don't mention molecules. It's like, well, that's kind of the centerpiece of what I do, so I can't do that. But that kind of gives you the idea of people tend to not want to hear about chemistry because they have some deep-seated discomfort with it. And I think it's a pretty cool opportunity to learn more about the world around us.
Mm-hmm. Cheryl, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. It was great to be here.
This episode was recorded at the Wright Center in downtown Mount Vernon in the beautiful facilities of the Department of Dance, Drama, and Film. My thanks go to my editor and junior producer, Elizabeth Aduma, Kenyon Class of 2020, who recorded this episode, edited it, and made it sound professional. Thank you also to the Center for Innovative Pedagogy that funded this project and consulted on it since the beginning.